The time is now. Hey everybody, Volume 1, Episode 6. This is Employment Law Now, and I'm Mike Schmidt, Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department here at Cozen O'Connor. Thank you so much for listening. There are some shows that just don't need any pomp and circumstance. They don't need to be sold. This is one of those shows. We're going to go right to our Special Guest Now segment today. I had a tremendous opportunity to have a one-on-one sit-down interview with the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, Richard Griffin. Yes, that NLRB, the federal agency that has appeared to be so much more proactive, maybe even pro-employee, since the beginning of the Obama administration. In terms of federal agencies, I really put the NLRB up there as a third of three pillars, if you will, of federal agencies, the EEOC, the Department of Labor, DOL, and the NLRB, in terms of what many believe are really an activist group of board, on the federal side at least. Dick Griffin was sworn in as the general counsel of the NLRB back on November 4th, 2013, and he's serving a four-year term that will come to an end later this year. In addition to being an actual board member before becoming the general counsel, Mr. Griffin also worked both sides of the employment law aisle. He worked the union and employee side of things, but he also has some experience dealing with the management side of employment law. Before you shut this off and say, well, I'll get back to this podcast in 2 weeks because this just doesn't affect or impact my facility and my company, it's really important to understand, as I say all the time, that the NLRB does not apply only to unionized facilities, those companies that have union employees. In fact, that's been one of the biggest things that the NLRB has tried to educate employers out there, that the NLRA and the NLRB, which is the agency that oversees and enforces the NLRA, applies both to union and non-union facilities. So you really need to continue to understand that. You need to understand that the NLRB issues really do apply to your company, regardless of its size. The Trump administration, starting this year, will likely change the NLRB and likely change the agenda that the NLRB has going forward. But unlike with some of the other agencies in Washington, it's not really going to happen so quickly. You have some staggered terms that are not coming to an end, and it's just going to take a long time, I believe, before you can really see a demonstrable change in the NLRB's agenda. So it's not going to happen as quickly as some may think, and obviously as some may like. But for purposes of today, Richard Griffin was speaking on a panel with other government officials and attorneys, and he graciously agreed to join my podcast and answer a few questions that I think many of you would have if you had an opportunity to ask him, such as what is his reaction to the reality or even the perception that employers have that the NLRB in the last few years has become very proactive and almost very pro-employee. Also, what does Mr. Griffin think about the NLRB's recent initiatives involving social media policies and the joint employment doctrine that so many employers have been wrestling with and have been on the wrong end of in some cases? So, we're not going to go through a lot of our usual segments in today's episode. Rather, because Mr. Griffin was so gracious to come on with me, I'm going to devote this entire episode to Mr. Griffin. So here we go, and I hope you enjoy it. So I've got the terrific honor of having Richard Griffin with us today on the podcast. Mr. Griffin is the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes today.
Sure, I'm happy to do it.
So for those who are not aware, can you give a sense to our listeners of exactly what your role has been as General Counsel and what role you play in setting policy and the NLRB's initiatives?
Well, the General Counsel of the NLRB is kind of a very interesting and fairly unique position because it has three primary responsibilities. The first is, under the National Labor Relations Act, employers and unions can commit unfair labor practices, which gets litigated through an administrative process. And the General Counsel is the chief prosecutor of unfair labor practices under the Act. So last year there were more than 21,000 unfair labor practice charges filed, and of those, two-thirds were dismissed, and of the one-third where merit was found, 92% were settled. But all that conduct with respect to unfair labor practices goes on in the regional offices of the board. There are 26 regional offices under the authority of the General Counsel, and the ultimate authority to issue an unfair labor practice complaint and prosecute it is in the General Counsel. That's the first main job of the General Counsel. The second aspect is once the board, the NLRB itself, which sits as kind of an administrative court of appeals, issues a final decision, the General Counsel represents the board, turns around, takes off the prosecutorial hat and puts on the lawyer hat and represents the board as the board's lawyer in the courts of appeals. Board orders are not self-enforcing. You have to go into the federal courts of appeals to seek an order of enforcement. People who want review can go into the federal courts of appeals to do that. And we actually have at the board in the General Counsel's office the second biggest appellate docket of any entity in the federal courts after the Justice Department. So that, and we also represent the board in court and district courts where there are cases that raise questions as well. And we coordinate with the Solicitor General's office in cases in the Supreme Court. That's the second job, as kind of the board's lawyer in the federal courts. The third job, and one that's actually the most time-consuming, is both by statute and by delegation of the board, the General Counsel is the chief administrative officer of the agency. So the agency has a little around 1,600 employees. It has a $274 million budget. It has 26 regional offices and a number of other offices. And so the administration of that is all largely done by the General Counsel's office.
And it's been said that the NLRB, unlike I guess the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor, is much more of a reactionary agency as opposed to one that affirmatively goes out and prosecutes cases.
Yeah, I mean, we are entirely reactive in the sense that the board, the agency doesn't have any independent investigatory authority. We have to wait for either an employee or a union or an employer to file an unfair labor practice charge. That triggers the investigation. And then we prosecute that charge if we decide to do so in the public interest. We take control of the case. It's not a private case, and there's no private right of action under the National Labor Relations Act. So all of the action with respect to what is or isn't an unfair labor practice essentially takes place in the administrative process.
And so much has been made about changes on the federal agency level with the new Trump administration. How, if at all, will the board's agenda be changing going forward?
Well, I think that's a question that we're going to have to see. Right now, there are five members of the board, and they are presidentially nominated and confirmed by the Senate. There are currently two vacancies. So the board currently has two Democratic members and one Republican member. Historically, the president's party gets the majority on the board, so the two vacancies are essentially Republican vacancies. The president can appoint those people. When they get appointed, there will then be a Republican majority, and we'll have to see what they decide to do. On the General Counsel side, my term is a four-year term that is up at the end of October, and so we'll have to see what what priorities the new general counsel chooses to set.
And so what's your reaction? So much of what I hear from clients, from companies, and business folks out there is they have this view that the board has become increasingly more, aggressive, maybe pro-employee, pro-union in a lot of respects. What's your reaction to that perception of employers?
Well, I think two things about it. First of all, I do think that the board, and certainly I would say I, take a very serious view about the importance of this statute and the importance of enforcing the law. And I think some people feel that we're being overly aggressive. The one thing I'd say is that there tends to be really a focus on what I consider to be the tip of the iceberg. As I said, there were 21,000 unfair labor practice charges filed last year. Two-thirds of those, around 65%, were dismissed after investigation. They were either withdrawn or dismissed. Merit was only found in one-third of the cases. That strikes me as a relatively conservative number, and that holds true over time. Republican or Democratic administration, those numbers are usually the same. And then of the cases, the one-third, or actually 35%, where merit was found, 93% of those cases settled before litigation. And again, around 90% is the historic figure. So the vast majority of the cases are resolved successfully at the regional level without any change of precedent, without any change of direction. And I anticipate that that's likely to go forward. There are big issues where, you know, the new board members may have a different view. But I don't think that that record, which is very consistent, that I just described, very consistent with historical practice, demonstrates a more activist board. It demonstrates that the board chooses wisely to go forward, because we dismiss two-thirds of the cases. We're not radical about that. And we settle 93% of the cases where we do find merit. And then when we actually litigate cases, we win about 89 or 90% of the cases. So I think that I would put that law enforcement prosecutorial record up against pretty much any other agency.
So what do you think is what prompted this perception on the employer side? Is it just a lack of understanding of what the NLRB is doing, or is it just a lack of education?
I think to some extent people are less familiar. I also think there is this view that the law does not apply outside the context of an active presence of a union, either a union in the workplace or a union seeking to organize the workplace. And the fact of the matter is that the law applies to all private sector workplaces and protects not just union organizing, but also what we call PCA, protected concerted activity. And the law has been very clear for a long time. There's a unanimous Supreme Court case from the early 1960s that involved workers in a coal plant who walked out in protest of the conditions, were fired for their walking out, and the Supreme Court unanimously held that they should be reinstated with back pay because they were engaged in protected concerted activity. The case called Washington Aluminum, NLRB versus Washington Aluminum. And the court emphasized in three or four places in the opinion that there was no involvement of a union, there was no seeking involvement of the union. These were people who were just acting together to advance their conditions. And that was held, you know, many years ago to be a perfectly valid exercise by the board of enforcement of the statute. So it is the case that the law applies in all private sector workplaces, with some exceptions that are statutory. But that is not an understanding that, if you forgive my phrase, employment lawyers as opposed to labor lawyers seem to accept in many contexts. And so they feel like the board is meddling where there's no union present. And I think that is an inaccurate view of what the statute requires.
And that's certainly a point that I make whenever and wherever I can in terms of the applicability of all this to non-unionized facilities as well. And that's a great segue. I just wanted to take a minute or two to just touch on two issues. There are so many issues and questions out there that the NLRB is getting involved in, but I wanted to just touch very briefly on two of them that are out there. You mentioned the protected concerted activity area, and obviously so much has been in the news and on Twitter and through other forms of social media for the past few years regarding employer social media policies and when and to what extent employers can make employment decisions based on the activity that employees are engaging in on social media. What's the best way to the NLRB for employers to navigate the realities of social media and employee activity that the company may not like?
I think I'd say a couple things about that. One is I have definitely heard, and my predecessor as general counsel definitely heard this concern coming from employers. And what we've tried to do is to be proactive in the sense of putting out guidance memos from the general counsel's office that address social media policies. Generally, my predecessor put one out that involved the Walmart social media policy and that involved employer rules generally. The board has also issued a number of decisions in this area. And the short answer is, when you look at activity on social media, you have to look at it not just as to whether or not you think it's somehow damaging the reputation of the company or hurting the company or adverse to the company's interest, but you also have to look at whether or not the content fits within the historic categories of protected concerted activity. And people have to understand that usually the reason employees get together and do things is not because they're happy, it's because they have a concern. And that concern frequently involves criticism of the way they're being treated, criticism of their wages are too low, criticism of too much required overtime, criticism of sexual harassment by supervisors. There's all kinds of things that people would say in social media that might make the company upset, but would otherwise be protected under the National Labor Relations Act if it was said, in the company break room. And so it's a little more disconcerting from the company standpoint if it's out there on the public web for everybody to see, and it may have different consequences, but that doesn't make it any more or less protected. So you have to do an analysis that gets at the nature of the activity and whether, for example, it's product disparagement. There's a line of cases that say, you can't disparage, just go out of your way to disparage the company's product, that's a legitimate basis for some kind of disciplinary action. And so if it's done on a website where an individual says, these widgets, they're completely defective, I don't know why anybody would buy one, and there's no connection to terms and conditions of employment, there's no joint activity, it's just somebody spouting off, that's one thing. If somebody says they make us work overtime, mandatory overtime, that means I can't pick up my child from childcare, and that means I am distracted, and that might have an adverse impact on what kind of work I do. And gee, Joe, don't you agree? And Joe says, yes, it's terrible that they're making us do mandatory overtime. That's, I think, as you can see, sort of a horse of a different color and might involve some NLRA considerations that might not be present in the first instance.
I think one of the points you just made, which is a critical one as well, is that it's not as if you created new rules for social media, but social media, in effect, is a new platform on which the old rules, the traditional rules, are just being applied.
That's 100% correct. I started my career at the NLRB as a staff counsel to a board member, but then I left after a couple of years and worked for 28 years for an international union that primarily represented construction workers. And one of the things we had to do was we had to look at all of the laws that govern the internal operation of unions. There's a separate statute, federal statute, called the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act that lays out all kinds of different rules and rights of members and ways disciplinary policies have to proceed and financial reporting and et cetera. And we had to look at how did the internet, how did the web, how did email affect the way members exercise their rights under the Landrieu-Griffin Act? So I'm not, and that's the shorthand term for the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. So I'm not unfamiliar with trying to, like, take this old wine and put it into a new bottle and figure out, you know, how it works, because I spent some time trying to do that in a different context. But you're 100% right. The manner of expression or the means of expression may have changed, but the protected nature of the expression or the unprotected nature, still you have to undergo kind of the same type of analysis.
And so what do you say to those who are trying to adapt to this new form, this new platform, who say, you know, we've been having policies that say you can't be insubordinate or you can't be rude to your coworkers and to your customers, and now they're hearing from lawyers and from others that you can't really have those kinds of generalized policies, and so they're a little bit confused as to why is the board stepping in trying to address or prohibit really things that have been in employee handbooks for decades.
Yeah, and this is something that I hear a lot of, and I've been trying to be very responsive to this concern. And what people need to understand is that for many, many, many years, there has been a legal standard at the board that if you have either a union or an employer has a broadly applicable rule that it maintains that could chill people's right to engage in conduct protected by the Act, that under the standard that the board has had, just mere maintenance of such a rule is considered a violation of the National Labor Relations Act. And the place that most employers, I think, will be familiar is in the area of no solicitation, no distribution rules. Almost every employer has a rule that addresses whether there can be solicitation in the workplace, whether materials can be distributed. There has been for a very long time a doctrine that says that if that rule conforms to certain standards, it's lawful. But if it goes beyond and prohibits solicitation that otherwise is allowed or prohibits distribution that's otherwise allowed, the mere maintenance of the rule violates the National Labor Relations Act. Well, if you take that principle, and it's true also for unions, if you have a rule that restricts members' ability to resign from the union, just maintaining the rule, even without enforcing it, violates the National Labor Relations Act. So what has been done over the last X period of time has been that sort of general principle has been applied to a fairly searching scrutiny of handbook provisions, because it has been the observation of, I think, board members that these things tend not to be drafted with the rules under the National Labor Relations Act in mind. And so I'll give you a classic example that we see all the time. It has been black letter law for a very long time that employer cannot have a rule that prohibits employees from talking about their wages and compensation. Nonetheless, we see in handbook after handbook rules that say wages and compensation are confidential information, and you can be disciplined if you disclose confidential information. This is unlawful. Nonetheless, there was a recent study that said that some 60% of employer handbooks surveyed contained some kind of similar limitation. So from my standpoint, and I understand it's a pain, although it is more work for people such as yourself.
Oh, come on, we're not in it for the work.
Employment lawyers. it is not a bad thing that employers need to review, from a public policy law enforcement standpoint, that employers need to review their handbooks to assure that they don't have provisions that violate the law. Now, having said that, the original thrust of your question was there's some things that seem innocuous on their face, but the board seems to be finding to be problematic, and can't we do something to do that better? And I agree with that. And so a couple years ago, I put out a fairly comprehensive general counsel memo that had language in all types of different areas that said this type of language is problematic, these are the reasons. This type of language is fine. That language is fine. We also, at the time, I have to give a shout out to the Wendy's Corporation, because Wendy's was involved in some, there were charges against some handbook rules that Wendy's had. Wendy's worked with us and the relevant regional office and the Division of Advice and came up with acceptable changes to their handbook rules to make them lawful, and they were willing to have us append those lawful rules as part of this memo. And so you have, if you want guidance or or you go to good lawyers, such as the host of this podcast, and ask for advice, you should be able to utilize that general counsel memo to assist in drafting lawful rules.
No, they certainly are very helpful. And the final question that I did want to ask, and I really appreciate your time. This is extremely informative in the 60 seconds or so that I still have you here. The other real issue, and it's been a real recent issue that's come up, is this joint employer issue. And you just finished speaking on a terrific panel for a little over an hour, so I'm asking you unfairly a question in about 60 seconds for a panel that an hour and 20 minutes was hardly enough. But this joint employer issue, first of all, what is the issue very quickly for those who have not followed it so closely?
Well, the issue is that the board in a case called Browning Ferris Industries changed the standard for finding joint employer status. And without getting into all the details of the change, it essentially made it easier to find joint employer status, which means that some entities might find themselves liable to engage in collective bargaining under the new standard that wouldn't have found themselves under the old standard.
And so this is a situation that comes up in with the staffing industry, the temp industry, certainly franchisor and franchisees. And so again, trying to react to employers and businesses out there who say, well, I'm trying to follow the law, I'm trying to do the right thing, I'm almost acting in a manner in which I've been acting for decades. So let's take the franchise or franchisee situation. There are those who say, I need to protect my brand and I do need to exercise some control, have some mechanisms out there so we can have uniformity and protect our brand. How do you respond to employers who say, well, we want to be able to protect our brand on the one hand, on the other hand, we don't want to go overboard and cross that line, so now we're becoming liable for things where we really don't have a day-to-day relationship with the employee?
I'd say two things. First of all, there are old board cases that address the franchisor's ability to protect the brand and say that where the franchisor is doing that and has some limited impact on terms and conditions of employment at the franchisee, that that's probably not sufficient to find joint employer status. And certainly my office is not seeking to overturn those cases, and we've said that publicly. The issue is the extent to which you go beyond protecting the brand and in the guise of protecting the brand start to have more active involvement in determining essential or sharing the co-determining essential terms and conditions of employment. I would recommend people take a look at an advice memo. That's a technical term. There's a division of advice that helps regional offices on tough questions in a case called Freshies, where we examined the situation under both the then current standard and under the argument, the standard we were arguing for in Browning Ferris, and found under both standards that the franchisor was not a joint employer with the franchisee, and look at the considerations there, and that might provide some guidance.
Well, this has been fascinating. Again, I am so honored to have you here, and speaking with me, this has been informative. If any of you want copies of any of the advice memoranda that Mr. Griffin's referred to, or any of the documents that have been put out to try to help and educate employers on these issues, whether it's the social media issue, whether it's the joint employer, or any of the other issues that they've been involved in, please let me know. Shoot me an email. Go over to our website, employmentlawnow.com, and post a comment, make a question. But again, we've been speaking with the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, Richard Griffin. Again, thank you so very much.
Sure. My pleasure. Great talking to you.
Thank you. Well, I hope you found that as informative as I did. We will continue to get outside guests on all kinds of different areas of the law, answering questions and addressing issues that I think are going to be most critical to your company and most impactful to your company's policies and practices. In the meantime, there is still a lot for you and I to catch up on when it comes to some real interesting developments and trends in the labor and employment world. So I'm going to be back in the next episode in a couple of weeks to talk about some things that have been going on and some things that I think you might want to take note of. Until then, I hope all of your labor is productive.